Hi, Mark Middleton along with Bill Schaefer, and this is Growing Bolder. And thank you for tuning in and joining us in our mission to change the way the world looks at aging.
That's our mission? That's a huge job, Mark. But you know what makes it a little easier? All of the amazing men and women out there right now who are smashing one stereotype after another and proving that it's never too late to find your purpose, to pursue your passion, to make a difference in your community.
Yeah, really, all we have to do is feature these role models for the Growing Bolder lifestyle on Growing Bolder TV, in Growing Bolder magazine, and right here on Growing Bolder Radio, which is what we're going to do right now. We've also got the woman who went on a global mission to meet and then be mentored by the world's greatest female runners to try and discover what we can all learn from them about living younger longer.
Plus, a renowned doctor who says we've got it all wrong when it comes to dealing with end-of-life issues.
Well, as everybody out there knows, Growing Bolder is about smashing stereotypes, and not because you want to, but because you want to live your life, because you refuse to buy into the ageist propaganda that it's too late to chase your dream, too late to make a difference. Well, our next guest has racked up an impressive $1.2 billion in box office with his films over the years.
You said billion right
billion,
there?
Billion, yeah.
Wow, well, he's appeared in over 80 films, so it's no wonder. He was in Robin Hood, Men in Tights, Dracula, Glory, Days of Thunder, Twister, Kill the Girls, and many others. But I'm telling you, Mark, his most famous role, at least to me, is in a true Hollywood classic. We're talking about Rob Reiner's 1987 film. You know what I'm talking about?
Absolutely.
The Princess Bride.
You'll get no argument here. It's been called one of the greatest love stories ever told, ranked by the Writers Guild of America as one of the top 100 screenplays ever produced. His new memoir, As You Wish, Inconceivable Tales from the Making of The Princess Bride, includes never-before-told behind-the-scenes stories. Welcome, Wesley Cary Elwes. Hey, Cary, how are you?
I'm great, thank you. How are you?
You know what? It is hard to believe. It makes me feel old when we realize that it's been 28 years since.
I know.
And it's more popular than ever. So let me start with a question I know you're probably sick of getting asked, because everybody does. What is it about this film that has created such a passionate and large fan base 3 decades later?
I'm never sick of answering that. I can't quite put my finger on it. I in the book, I try to address it. Of what I believe the reason is, but I think, and it's just my opinion. So I can't justify it for other people. But I think it's because it's a great love story, and the film was made with a lot of heart. You know, I mean, the whole concept of the film, of the story itself, the book, Bill Goldman, who wrote it, came up with the idea by asking his two daughters what would they want him to write a book about. One of them said brides and the other said princesses. Hmm. So he wrote it for them. So the whole project initially started with a man, concerned about writing something sweet and loving for his kids. And I think that set the tone for us. And I think that's why it resonates today. I hope, I think.
You know, Cary, it kind of makes me wonder, how did it resonate with you? Was it one of those things that, I'm sure you get tons of scripts that you look through, did you realize something when you read it, or was it once you were on the set and met the other actors, or was it not until you were sitting in the theater watching it for the first time yourself?
I knew the book. I'd read it when I was 13, so I was very familiar with the work of William Goldman. I was a huge fan and still am a huge fan of his. He's one of the, I think, our national treasures. As far as writers are concerned, I mean, this is a man who wrote Marathon Man, All the President's Men, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and so and of all these films that he's written, this is his favorite. So, I also was well aware of Rob Reiner's work. I'd seen, like most people, I'd seen Spinal Tap, which is a classic, and Sure Thing and Stand By Me, and I thought the combination of these two extraordinary, talented people was going to be something extraordinary. You know, I just thought that this was an incredible opportunity for me. We didn't know making it, obviously. No one does when you make a film that it's going to have, be successful or have an audience. We hoped it would. And in fact, when the film came out, it really didn't do that much of the box office. It did well. It was respected, had a respectable response, but it didn't do the kind of numbers that the studio was hoping. And it wasn't until about 10 years later when it came out in VHS that people started renting it, then buying it, and then giving it as gifts to family and friends. And so it became this generational thing. I call it the gift that keeps on giving, you know?
Folks, we're talking with Cary Elwes, who has written a memoir. Surprisingly, the first book, to my knowledge, that has been written about the making of The Princess Bride. And, of course, Cary today is known worldwide as not only a phenomenal actor, but also a great guy. But back then, Cary, you were in your early 20s, relatively unknown, when they were casting for the film, as perfect as you ended up being for Wesley, you still had to audition for Rob Reiner. Obviously, that went pretty well.
Yeah, well, thank you for those kind words, by the way. I didn't think I was going to get the part because I'm terrible at auditions. I more often than not, I get roles that are offered to me as opposed to ones I read for. And so I thought, well, they're going to ask me to read, and that's that. And when Rob pulled out the script in my hotel room in Germany, I was working in Berlin at the time, and said, I just want to hear a scene. I just thought, well, that's it. It's over. And somehow we were chatting afterwards, and we're talking about popular culture, and I was explaining to Rob how I knew his work and All in the Family, and how I'd watched a lot of TV as a kid. And for some reason, Fat Albert came up. I don't know why, but I ended up doing a a Fat Albert impersonation, which Rob seemed to like. And later on, he said it was a combination of my humor and the read that got me the part. So I feel grateful to get one of the great roles of my career.
That may be a story that he has never heard.
Oh, I'm sure he has by now.
Hey, Cary, it wasn't just you, though. I mean, when you look at the people in that movie, I mean, how could it not have been?
I call it a tsunami of talent. I was, again, well aware of all of their work. Coming into the project, you know, I'd seen Dog Day Afternoon a number of times. So Chris Sarandon, who got nominated for his very first performance in that film, was you know, very much lived large in my world. And Mandy, I knew him from Yentl, Wallace Shawn from My Dinner with Andre. I mean, I looked around at this room of people for the first read-through, and I just thought, wow, I'm clearly the novice in this room, you know? And
Cary,
it was a little intimidating.
Can you help us out?
But they all made me feel very, very welcome, and it was just it was a very pleasant experience for me.
Help us understand that, because, like, in my own life, I remember one time when I got to meet my childhood heroes in person, and it was like the most disappointing thing I ever did. Who in the cast exceeded your expectations of what you thought was going to happen?
I must say, they all did. They all were just as I imagined and hoped they would be. There was no egos on this set. It was just a case of having fun. It was like, really, it was like theater camp. All of us, you know, running around the English countryside dressed as pirates and princesses and being chased by six-fingered people. I mean, it's hilarious. And Rob set the tone. You know, I mean, Rob is he's a wonderful guy anyway, but he's a really great guy to work with. And he handpicked not just the cast, but most of the crew. So he wanted to make sure that when we went on this journey, it would be a fun and exciting one for everyone. And he did that.
And this is why you got to read the book. I mean, we do not have enough time. Most films, if we were talking about them, there'd be one or two scenes that we'd want to talk about. I'd like to talk about every single freaking scene in this movie. But let me ask you about when you were playing dead,
yes.
And Billy Crystal is trying to bring you back to life. I mean, he was hilarious. I can only imagine what the outtakes were like.
Oh, gosh. Well, we couldn't print them all. Some of them, they started to get pretty blue. He was doing Yiddish stand-up. You know, Rob gave him a free rein. He just went up to him and went, okay, go for it. And then he walked over to me and went, now remember, you're playing mostly dead. You're not allowed to breathe. We can't see your chest move. Nothing. So when I yell action, you got to hold your breath. I thought, well, I'm done for. You know, the minute he opened his mouth, Billy is Miracle Max, you know, we all bust out laughing. I mean, you know, his first improvisation was, don't rush me, Sonny. Last night I found my nephew with the sheep. You know, I mean, things like that. And Mandy bust a rib from laughing so much. Rob had to be banned from the set because his laugh can be heard, I like to say it can be heard in Detroit. He has a very robust laugh. So he was sent by the sound department to the hallway to watch from a monitor there. And then, of course, you know, I think Billy made it his mission to make us all laugh. When he started to push air out of my lungs, he tickled me a bit too. You know, I mean, it was crazy. So I was banished with Rob also off the soundstage because I couldn't stop laughing. So it was, you know, it was only 3 days he was there, but he had us all on the floor. I mean, you can, I think there's a site you can go to on YouTube where it has some of the outtakes. You can hear the whole crew laughing. I mean, it's crazy.
And it all came through so well, Carrie, and it kind of underscores the kind of person you are, your reputation in an industry of suspect characters is beyond reproach. Do you have a takeaway for us, Carrie, a philosophy of how you've lived your life and what you can pass along to the rest of us, what you've learned?
Count your blessings every day. It's very easy to focus on the negative, but if you focus on the positive, you realize just how blessed you, even the smallest blessings are worth counting. And so I make sure I start my day with that philosophy and that focus rather than anything that could possibly, you know, be, you know, the opposite. Yeah.
Well, you've put out a lot of good vibes into the universe, Carrie, and obviously they've come back to you. Folks, I know you'd like to listen to him more. You can visit him again on the pages of his new book. It's called As You Wish, Inconceivable Tales from the Making of the Princess Bride. He is Carrie Elwes. Carrie, thanks so much for your time. Coming up, he needed a double organ transplant and was running out of options. How Dee Bennett went from barely surviving to thriving. That's next on Growing Bolder. Stay connected to Growing Bolder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram for our latest stories, reels, and motivational memes.
Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton, and this is Growing Bolder. Time now for our Surviving and Thriving segment. With the right kind of care and support and the right attitude, it's possible not only to survive life's greatest challenges, but to thrive in the aftermath.
Yeah, Dee Bennett wasn't even thinking about thriving. He was just trying to survive, and it didn't look good for Dee. He needed a double organ transplant, and time was running out. Dee Bennett was battling several health conditions when he had a negative reaction to long-term exposure to two drugs, one over-the-counter and another by prescription.
And I was a pretty good drinker, so when you drink on top of all of that stuff, it just further damages things. I started going downhill big time. Early January, I called my parents and said, come get me. I've gotten up out of the chair and I won't be able to do it again, so get me to the hospital.
Dee was in and out of assisted living facilities and hospitals and ended up in dialysis. His liver was shot and his kidneys were failing. The only thing that could save him now was a double transplant.
Yeah, at that time he was pretty sick. So if he didn't get a transplant probably in the next 4 or 6 weeks from when he came, I don't think he would have been around. He was very debilitated, and I think that's why the other centers probably turned him down, knowing that he may not turn around.
So my hope really was reignited, and I can't tell you how sweet and kind everybody over there is to deal with. In the prayers that went out by everybody in that hospital and the support by everybody, down to the person that's cleaning your room that would come in and spend time with you and support you, everybody. It was just a wonderful experience.
Transplant requires a team approach. not only the surgeons, it's our colleagues, our medical colleagues, our nephrologists, our hepatologists, and the nurses. So you want to build a core group of people because you're working 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and we rely on each other.
Dee also credits his parents who brought him dinner every night and stood by his side every day for months.
And without my parents' help, I never would have gotten through any of this. They were there the whole time. They lived in Comfort Inn across the street from the hospital for 4 months. They lived in a hotel room.
It took months to recover from his double transplant surgery, but Dee soon felt better than he had in years. So much better that he went to his 35th high school reunion and began a relationship with someone he hadn't seen in decades. They soon became business partners, purchasing two assisted living facilities where they provide the kind of support that Dee now knows is critical to surviving and thriving. Good food and plenty of social stimulation.
Our people have to come out and sit at the breakfast, lunch, and dinner table. And it means a lot to interact. Where I was, they never did that. You were served in bed, and they, you know, it was easy for them to babysit you and leave you in a room. It was the easiest thing that they could do, but that is actually the worst thing for a patient.
Dee is definitely making the most of the second chance given to him by the doctors and, of course, by his donor. A timely reminder to all of us about the importance of becoming an organ donor.
Up next, a man who has his sights on becoming the oldest Winter Olympian ever and how he hopes to make that happen. This is Growing Boulder. Sign up for the Growing Boulder Insider newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingboulder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Boulder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingboulder.com/podcasts. You're listening to Growing Boulder. I am Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton. And why would anybody in his right mind want to jump on a sled and hurl himself down an icy mountain at over 80 miles an hour? Well, at the age of 21, Ruben Gonzalez took up the sport of luge and he started training for the Olympics. 4 years and at least that many broken bones later, Ruben made his Olympic dream come true.
It's a great story if it ended there, but that was just the beginning. He kept training, he kept working, he kept lugeing, and now he has his sights set on becoming the oldest Winter Olympian ever. If he makes the team in Beijing in 2022, he'll be 59 years old. In the meantime, he's written his fifth best-selling book. It's called The Courage to Succeed. Let's get a little shot of that inspiration now from four-time Winter Olympian Ruben Gonzalez. Ruben, how you doing today?
Doing great. How are y'all doing?
You know, something told me you were doing great. I imagine you find a way to do great each and every day. And speaking of doing great, your book is doing great. You're all over the place now doing motivational talks. What's the Gonzalez message? What are you telling people?
You know what? I try to take people's excuses away. Everybody lets fear of failure and fear of the unknown hold them back. And through my crazy Olympic story, I try to give them hope, sprinkle a little pixie dust on them so they'll face their fears and, charge on forward.
And you mentioned crazy Olympic story. And it's really different because anyone who thinks of you just as a luge competitor is missing the point. Yeah, it's a passion of yours. But isn't it true that even maybe a bigger passion is the study of success and how to achieve it?
That's a great point. Ever since I was a kid, I was intrigued by what makes successful people successful. We live in the land of opportunity, and what are the principles? And I've been a student of success all my life, and now I just try to pass the torch to people, whether I'm sitting across from them over coffee or in front of a big crowd at an event.
So give us an idea, Ruben, about why you've done what you've done, because longevity in any sport is unusual. Longevity in Olympic sports is almost unheard of because you only really get to go for it once every 4 years. And longevity in a sport that has seen so much technical evolution as yours has makes it even more difficult. How have you been able to put yourself on a luge in four different Olympics?
You know, my coaches say that I'm like a really old car that doesn't have that many miles on it. I've taken a lot of breaks, and that's actually worked for me. It wasn't planned that way. It's just the way it happened. The first two Olympics, Calgary 88 and Albertville 92, I did back-to-back. But then I took a six-year break, and my coach convinced me to get back into the game. I started training. I made the Salt Lake City Olympics. Another 6 or 7 year break, and I made the Vancouver Games, and now I just came back after another. I have a weird 7 year itch. I get bored after 7 years. I got to get back on that sled. And the coaches, when I came back, they said, "You're sliding better than ever. You've been sitting in that desk so long, you know, building your business. We need to, you do a little yoga and stretching. We're going to stretch you out, but mentally you're stronger than ever, and you got a shot." And that's all I can ask for, a shot.
You know, you're in your 50s now. Do you still look as good in that luge spandex as you did many years ago?
You know what? I think the catalyst for this last comeback is I had started to put on weight. You know, it just crept up on me. And I made a decision that I wanted to look good again. And I lost 25 pounds.
Wow.
And then I was on this magazine shoot. They wanted me to put on that luge suit. I put it on, I looked in the mirror, I thought, hey, looking pretty good. And that just started percolating those ideas, and that's what made me come back. So to answer your question, believe it or not, I'm in better shape than I was in college.
Wow.
I may not be as fast, but I look better in that luge suit. Let me qualify that. And that's what I try to get across to people, you know. Just because, you know, you might have a little ache and pain here or there, that's okay. You know, mentally you're stronger and you have all this knowledge and wisdom, man, why not? And my hope is that when I break this record, I don't want it. I'm going to break a record that hasn't been broken in over 70 years since 1924. And I hope that my Olympic record doesn't last but 4 years, because my goal is to inspire other guys and other gals to get out of the, you know, get back into that arena and do it.
Yeah, that's what's so interesting about you, Ruben, because your story, from your point of view, isn't really about you. It's about the rest of us, because your story is, here's a kid who was the last person ever picked for any sports team, the last person anybody ever expected to excel, certainly in any kind of athletics, but you found a way to do it, and you found a way to stick with it and succeed. What can we learn from you?
You know, when I climbed a few years ago, I read Hemingway a lot when I was a kid, and he put all these ideas in my head. And a few years ago, we hired a guide and climbed Kilimanjaro, and the last day was 18 hours of climbing. And I've never been so tired in my life, but I realized that, gosh, we can do so much more, you know. Don't let that mind tell you that you're too tired to keep going, because you've got so many reserves. And so you can do more. I think that's the main thing. All of us can do more.
We're talking to Ruben Gonzalez, who's going to make an attempt to become the oldest winter Olympian ever in 2022. He's already a four-time winter Olympian. And, you know, Ruben, one of the many things we like about you is your message, and you mentioned it earlier, about taking risks. Because as people get older, you know, by nature, we seem to become more and more risk-averse. And when we don't take chances, our world just becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. What have you found works when it comes to inspiring people to get out of their comfort zone?
You know, when I was a kid, my dad got me reading biographies. He said, if you'll study the lives of great people, you'll figure out what works and what doesn't work in life, because success leaves clues. So I started reading them. And my favorite ones were always the ones about people that had to overcome huge challenges to make their dreams come true. The General Pattons, the Mother Teresa, the Helen Kellers, the Wilma Rudolphs. When I read stories, they took my excuses away. And so now through my story, how a bench warmer that didn't even get started in the luge till he was 21 got to go to the Olympics. I want people walking out of my presentations or after reading my book, I want them thinking, man, if that guy can go to the Olympics, we can do anything, right? I want to put a little pixie dust in their life and fill them with belief. Because if you believe, you have belief today, and you believe that something's possible, you got power. You're ready to take action. And if you want it badly enough, nothing will make you quit.
Something else, Ruben, that never goes away, I'm not sure if you agree with this or not, we all have the desire to do something great. You know, we all want to be somebody that other people look up to. Doesn't it seem, have you found that as we age, we start to believe that that's less and less possible?
I think that, most people let that mentality, right, that poison get in their mind. But again, we're wiser. Modern medical techniques and proper nutrition, and I think anybody can thrive much longer than they think. And so I think it's possible. You just have to. I tell people the same thing my dad said: who are you going to hang around with, right? If you hang around people you respect and people you admire and people that are doing things, you'll start picking up their habits, you'll start doing those things, you'll start thinking like them. But if you hang around a bunch of people that are whining and complaining and bragging to each other about all their medical issues, then that's where you're going to go. It's all about who you hang around with.
This guy is interesting. He's inspiring, and man, he can help you discover how to make your life more fulfilling. The book is called The Courage to Succeed. Our thanks to four-time Olympian Ruben Gonzalez, and good luck on your quest to be the oldest Winter Olympian.
Coming up next, older, faster, stronger, what the world's best older runners can teach us all about living younger, longer. That's next on Growing Bolder.
Sign up for the Growing Bolder Insider newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingbolder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Bolder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingbolder.com/podcasts.
I'm Mark Middleton along with Bill Schaefer, and this is Growing Bolder. And you know, folks, it's no secret that life beyond 50, 60, 70, even 80 and 90 is nothing like it was even 10 or 20 years ago.
Yeah, now that doesn't always mean that everybody is living differently as they grow older, but it does mean that we all have the potential to live much differently. We know that from the stories we do every day for Growing Bolder TV, Growing Bolder Magazine, and Growing Bolder Radio.
And our next guest knows it as well, because she not only lives it, she's written a book about it. It's called Older, Faster, Stronger, What Women Runners Can Teach Us All About Living Younger, Longer. Let's welcome Margaret Webb. Hey, Margaret, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great. Love the subject. Let me set it up quickly if I can. You were an athlete in college. You went on to become a very successful journalist and author. But like so many of us do, you didn't stay in the kind of shape that you thought you should. So when you turned 50, what happened?
Oh, well, I was actually a couple of years before I turned 50. I was staring down that bullet. And I tell you, it terrified me. I wanted more life, and I had this sense that life is over at 50, and I really didn't want that to happen. So this crazy idea of running a marathon popped into my head. I swore I'd never run one, but I thought, hey, why don't I go with this crazy idea? And the funny thing is that everything that was ailing me, my anxiety about turning 50, sort of this depression that had set in, running seemed to fix everything. My confidence soared. I felt younger. I lost 25 pounds. I started sleeping better. I quit smoking. And when I turned 50, it was usually I dread my birthday, but on my 50th birthday, it was one of the happiest days of my life.
And Margaret, it grabbed you, not just physically, but mentally too. I mean, you went off on a journey that took you all across North America. It took you to Africa. It took you to Europe. You were looking everywhere to find people living the life that you wanted. You were looking for advice from the most successful older runners in the world.
Yeah, I'm a bit of an adventure girl, and the more I ran, the more hungry I got for adventure. And I really saw this journey into aging as an adventure. So I wanted to explore not just the science of aging and the science of exercise, but I wanted to meet these fantastic older women like Ida Hebert, the world's oldest yoga instructor, 97 years old, and that woman is still doing the downward dog better than I can. And I wanted to meet people like 85-year-old BJ McHugh, who can run a marathon at age 80. She ran a marathon faster than the average 20 to 40-year-old woman does in the New York City Marathon. And so these were the mentors that showed me that it was possible to really achieve the impossible, and that is to have the fitness of a much younger person, but with the wisdom of a 50-year-old. So I felt that when I worked my way through this 50th year, that's what I achieved. You know, I had the fitness of a much younger person, but thank God some of the wisdom of my years.
And, you know, it's great news for all of us. And you know, Margaret, Bill and I have built our business basically on the backs of ordinary people. You know, we like to tell stories of ordinary people that are doing extraordinary things because those are the role models that we can all relate to. And pretty much, isn't that what you found out yourself as you went to meet these icons of running, these women that you admired? When it came right down to it, they were ordinary women that somehow had created an extraordinary life, correct?
You know, absolutely. And I spoke, one of the first people I spoke to on my journeys, because I kind of wanted to interview women who are sort of in their 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, who showed me the path, showed me that it was possible, that if I keep physically fit, I can keep my my mental health, and I can keep my cognitive well-being. My brain will stay young if my body stays young. And Linda Somers-Smith, who qualified for the U.S. Olympic trials 7 straight times, and her 7th time at in her 50s, and she told me, you know what, I need mentors. We don't, as women, we don't necessarily have these examples of successful older women, and I mean successful on an everyday level of staying fit. And so I went out to find those and talk with them, interview them, and I met people like Gwen McFarland, who was extraordinary. She started running at age 60 after being diagnosed with breast cancer, and she didn't know that she would survive, and she credits running with extending her life into her 80s. And again, at age 75, she ran a world record marathon 15 years after taking up running that was faster than the average finishing time of 20 to 40-year-old men in the New York City Marathon. So here we have these women in 75 and 80 who can kick the butt of young men in their prime. And I thought, well, you know what? There's no reason. I mean, I might not run a world record marathon for my age group, but there's no reason I can't go after that level of fitness, because I want to have that youthful vigor when I'm that age.
You know, Margaret, we hear you, and everybody listening says, I know she's right, but so few of us can do it. Have you learned anything about what keeps us from being able to get off the couch and not just start running, but continue to stay in shape?
Yeah, you know, it is the tough part. The motivation, I think, is number one. And I think that personal trainers, the whole fitness industry, they don't really address that number one issue enough. And for myself, I said to myself, as I started to run and feel better, I said, what kind of body do I want to carry me through the next 3 decades of my life? Do I want it to be a 50-year-old body that's going to continue to age? Or do I want to reset the biological clock? You know, can I get to the fitness of a 20 or 30-year-old and have that body carry me through the next 30 or 40 years? And that's a decision I made. And once I made that decision and, you know, got support, boy, did I ever go out and get support, because I don't think this is something we can do alone. I joined a running club. I got a personal trainer. I got a team of experts around me. And why not? Why wait? why wait till we have a team of like doctors and people who are fixing us around us? Why not get the prevention people around us? And they help motivate me. I worked with a sports psychologist. I did a couple of sessions with her, and they help me put into the mind frame that every time I wake up, every day I wake up, what am I going to do today for my physical fitness? And the answer is to go. There's never am I going to do something today? No, the answer is I'm going to do something today. What is it going to be? And I think we can train our mind to do this. And the beautiful thing is once our bodies get fit, our bodies crave fitness. It craves exercise, and we want that healthy lifestyle every bit as much as we might have wanted a cocktail after work before. So I think that's the big message. And most of the women that I met on my travels, they didn't start running really until they're in their 50s. I have an older sister who went back to the gym at age 50 after not being that active during her life. And she ended up becoming an Ironman 8 years later. And if that's not an example in my life, wow.
Well, there are a lot of great examples in the book, folks. It's called Older, Faster, Stronger. It changed Margaret Webb's life. It can change your life as well, filled with the common denominators, the threads that run through the lives of these amazing women, these incredible, iconic older runners. Pick it up, read the book, and I know you'll be happy you did. Margaret, thanks so much. Have you heard about the silver tsunami? Up next, Dr. Brad Stewart on creating an entirely new end-of-life model before it's too late. That's next on Growing Bolder.
In the glimpse of our past, fades away so fast, like a castanet dance in the night. In the glimpse of our past, fades away so fast, like a castanet dance in the night. Shabby corks popping late at night.
Embrace the health and longevity movement with the Fountain of Youth monthly e-newsletter. Growing Boulder and the National Senior Games Association have teamed up to bring you the latest videos, podcasts, and articles on inspirational masters athletes and the many benefits of physical activity delivered right to your inbox. Just go to nsga.com/connect to sign up for free today. The Fountain of Youth, because if you want to keep moving, you have to keep moving.
This is Growing Bolder. I'm Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton, and our next guest has spent 4 decades passionately advocating for home-based primary care for the chronically and terminally ill. He believes that to fix American health care, that first we have to fix the end-of-life care model.
Yeah, and this is obviously a very timely and emotional subject for all of us. America's 78 million baby boomers are now losing an average of nearly 5,000 parents every single day, and that number will continue to rise over the next 20 years as we become the ones facing end-of-life issues. Let's jump into this fascinating topic as we welcome Dr. Brad Stewart. Hey, Dr. Stewart, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Well, thanks for all that you are doing in keeping this conversation going, because there is no question the vast majority of us would prefer to die at home. But somehow we end up in hospitals and care centers where our quality of life is poor, the costs are astronomical. Why are we paying enormous amounts of money to die in places we don't want to be? What's wrong with the system?
Well, it's a lot of it's force of habit, I'm afraid, on the part of doctors who, you know, were trained in hospitals. That's where we try to make people better, and we try very hard all the way to the end of life. For in most cases, even when people, I'm not going to call them patients, when people are very old, and also it's habit on the part of us. I mean, we love our parents, and when they're ailing or sick, we are used to calling 911 or taking them to the hospital. And unless we have a chance to talk it through and realize there's another way, we take the easy way out, which is exactly what you described.
You said something really interesting there. You call them people instead of patients. Do we tend to look at death as something that's got to be avoided at all costs instead of an inevitability?
Yeah, I use the word. I honestly have gotten uncomfortable over my time as a physician with the word patient because there are better ways to do this. But as long as we doctors and everyone, doctors, nurses, everyone, assumes that older people who are ill are patients, then we've lost the game before we even start. When you see people at home where they actually live, where they're safe and comfortable, and where we can do an increasingly large number of very sophisticated things to keep them the way they want to be, which is, believe me, not going back to the hospital, then it's and treat them as people and find what they want and follow that. Surprising things can happen, and it doesn't just have to do with dying. It really has to do with living. People live differently when they realize they can be independent. And this is America, and these days, until the last day of your life, you can be pretty independent with great support. So that's what we're after here.
And thank you again for doing what you're doing, because we need experts like you who tell us, what this new model can be. And, Bill and I are trying to do our part by talking about it, because, that really, I think, is where it all begins. As you noted, we don't want to talk about these kind of things until it gets to be too late to have these other options. So what can we do? How do we change Medicare? How do we get people to prepare to die in their homes instead of in these cold places that we don't want to be?
Well, I really want to take up with what you just said. I'm very grateful that you are willing to talk about it, because it is hard. But the reason it's hard is because we have put sort of a pall over the whole topic. Once you see people able to function, until very, very late in their lives, happy with their families, able to get up and come to the dinner table, it's not such a hard topic. Going back to people instead of patients, it's not until when you get into people's homes and you ask them what they want, you'll hear things like, I want to see my daughter graduate from get her PhD, or my granddaughter graduate from high school, or I want to get to the dinner table with my family. Very ordinary, non-medical stuff. Once we help with that, people do better. And I think Medicare is only too glad to help with this, because everybody understands that we can do much better than we're doing. So we're working with Medicare right now. We have a meeting set up in a short time with them to talk through how to get some of these new models established, because they're being done now in many large health systems, and they're being supported by many large health plans, insurance companies, doctor groups, hospitals. Everybody's waking up to this, but it's hard to get over the bridge from here to there, because we have habits that are hard to break, and we have payment systems that need to change. So that's I think the biggest barrier right now to getting quickly over to where we need to be.
Talking with Dr. Brad Stewart, and Doc, you've launched a new company called Advanced Care Innovation Strategies. What is your new business all about?
Well, it's just a small consulting group. We started and developed a program called Advanced Illness Management at a large health system on the West Coast, and wound up getting a large grant from the Center for Medicare Medicaid Innovation to roll that program out across the entire 24 hospital system. And it became clear we were already working in Washington with a group called CTAC, Coalition to Transform Advanced Care. And there were so many places that want to learn how to do this that we just felt that it was important to help, everyone who wants to know how this can be done to begin to do it. So through SeaTac and with ACI strategies, you know, we're getting not only getting the word out, but changing the way healthcare is delivered. Everybody wants to do it, believe it or not, including all the hospitals and all the doctors. But the how of how to do it, it's complicated. Lots of moving parts. Lots of people who are very well trained to do things in a way that worked pretty well last generation, but not so much now. So we're just helping people get over the bridge to a new kind of healthcare.
And, you know, as we face this silver tsunami that everybody talks about that potentially could be devastating globally as the world begins to age, we've got to figure out how to deal with these things. And folks, I think the bottom line here is that Dr. Stewart does not believe the hospital is the right place for most elderly people, that home medical care is. And Doc, in the final 30 seconds, what's the biggest challenge you face in trying to move us to a home-based primary care model?
Well, the biggest challenge is the payment system, and that's where Medicare is trying to figure out new ways. As a doctor for years, we have an old system of getting paid by the piece, like a little old mom and pop shop where everything you do gets paid for. In the new way, we begin to, as health systems, begin to take actually financial risk for our own patients. So we become like health plans. And we actually try to do the right thing instead of everything that can be done. And getting that payment system changed is the biggest thing.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Dr. Brad Stewart. We really appreciate your time trying to help us figure out how to die with dignity and live until the very end. He is Dr. Brad Stewart.
Help motivate you even just a little to realize it's never too late to get off the couch and get into life.
And before we leave today, our takeaway is from Ben Franklin, who was pretty much a quote machine. Franklin said, quote, "Most people die at 25 and aren't buried until they're 75, meaning, of course, that far too many of us stop learning, stop growing, stop trying once we reach a certain age, and then it's just autopilot until the end.
Yeah, that's like the exact opposite of growing bolder, because it's about never giving up. You never stop learning, and you never stop growing, and never stop believing that the rest of your life is going to be the best of your life. We'll see you next time.
The Growing Boulder Radio Show is a production of Growing Boulder, LLC, all rights reserved. This program was recorded at Growing Boulder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nanis. And our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.
Crimson flames tied through my ears, flowing high and mighty trapped. Countless fire and flaming rope, using ideas as my maps. We'll meet on edges soon, said I, proud neath heated brow. Ah, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. Half right prejudice leap for, rip down all hate I scream. Foundation deep somehow. Oh, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. In a soldier's stance, I aim my hand at the mongrel.
older then, I'm younger than that now. Deceived me into thinking I had something to protect. Good and bad, I defined these terms quite clear, no doubt, somehow. Ah, but I was so much older.